Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Steve Brown. Tonight we present the 2010 Howard Zinn Memorial Lecture in honor of the late Boston University Professor Emeritus of Political Science. The featured speaker is veteran broadcast journalist and political commentator Bill Moyers. We begin with an introduction by Alex McDonald, Boston University College of Arts and Sciences, class of 1972.
I could stand here for a half hour singing the accolades of Bill Moyers, but I'll just touch on a few. He was one of the founders of the Peace Corps, working with Sergeant Shriver in the Kennedy administration. He is the recipient of more than 30 Emmys for his breakthrough shows on PBS, most particularly Bill Moyers' Journal. There's one aspect of tonight's gathering that is not widely known, and that is that after so many decades on air, Bill had promised his beloved wife, Judith, that starting in April of 07, when the PBS series finally ended, they would have a year to themselves. No schedule, no obligations. He made one exception to that rule, and that was to agree with the blessing of Judith to make one exception, and that was to be with us here tonight. It is my great honor to bring to the stage Mr. Bill Moyers.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, Alex, for that introduction. Thank you for that welcome, and thank you, Dean and the faculty and others, for this invitation. So I'd like to begin tonight with where I think Howard would begin, with everyday lives. When she heard the news, Connie Brazel cried like a baby. For years, she had worked at minimum wage jobs until 17 years ago when she was hired by Whirlpool Refrigerator Factory in Evansville, Indiana. She was making $18.44 an hour at Whirlpool when the company announced earlier this year that it was closing the operation and moving it to Mexico. She wept. I am sure many of the 1,100 people who lost their jobs wept too. They had seen their ticket to the middle class snatched from their hands. The company, of course, defended its decision by claiming high cost, underused capacity, and the need to stay competitive. Those excuses didn't dry Connie Brazel's eyes. I was becoming part of something bigger than me, she told Stephen Greenhouse of the New York Times. Whirlpool was the best thing that ever happened to me. She was not only sad, she was mad. They didn't get world-class quality because they had the best managers, she said. They got world-class quality because of the United States and because of their workers. Among those workers were Natalie Ford, her husband, and her son. All three lost their jobs at Whirlpool. It's devastating, Natalie Ford told the Times. Her father had worked at Whirlpool before them, and now she said, there aren't any jobs here. How is this community going to survive? Well, what about our country? Between 2001 and 2008, about 40,000 U.S. manufacturing plants closed. 6 million factory jobs have disappeared over the past dozen years, representing one in three manufacturing jobs. Natalie said to the Times, what many of us are wondering, I don't know how, without good-paying jobs here in the United States, people are going to pay for their health care, put their children through school, and take care of themselves in their old age. Now, if Connie Brazel and Natalie Ford lived in South Carolina, they might have been lucky enough to get a job there with the new BMW plant that recently opened. The plant advertised they would hire 1,000 workers. Among the applicants, according to the Washington Post, a former manager of a major distribution center for Target, a consultant who oversaw construction projects in four western states, a supervisor at a plastics recycling firm. Some held college degrees, probably from Boston University, and resumes in other fields where they made more money. They will be paid $15 an hour, about half of what German workers for BMW make. Maybe we should have lost the war and let them rebuild us. In polite circles where euphemisms blossom, among the political and financial class, this is known as the free market at work. Sorry, no. It's wage repression. Wage repression. I want to share with you some statistics. I know statistics can cause eyes to glaze over, but reportedly, it's the mark of a truly educated person to be deeply moved by statistics. Well, this is a truly educated audience, so you should be moved by the recent analysis of tax data by economists Thomas Piketty and Emmanuel Saatz. They found that from 1950 through 1980, the share of all income in America going to everyone but the rich increased from 64 to 65%. Because the nation's economy was growing handsomely, the average income for 9 out of 10 Americans was growing too, from $17,719 to $30,941. That's a 75% increase in average income in constant $2,008 dollars. But then it stopped. And get this, since 1980, the economy has also continued to grow handsomely, but only a fraction at the top have benefited. For the bottom 90%, the line flattened out. Average income, listen to this, average income went from that $30,941 in 1980 to $31,244 in 2008. Think about it. The average income of Americans increased just $303 over 28 years. That's wage repression. Another story in the Times caught my eye a few weeks after I read about Connie Brazel and Natalie Ford. The headline said, "Industries find surging profits in deeper cuts." And the reporter, Nelson Schwartz, one of the best, reported that despite falling motorcycle sales, Harley-Davidson profits are soaring, with a second quarter profit of $71 million, more than triple what it had earned the previous year. Yet, Harley-Davidson has announced plans to cut 1,400 to 1,600 more jobs by the end of this year, this on top of the 2,000 jobs it cut last year. Schwartz concluded, "This seeming contradiction, falling sales and rising profits, is one reason the mood on Wall Street is buoyant and where the mood in households across the country is pessimistic." There you see the two Americas, a buoyant Wall Street, a doleful Main Street. The Connie Brazels and the Natalie Fords have been left to sink or swim on their own. There were no bailouts for them. Meanwhile, in USA Today, Matt Krantz reports that cash is gushing into companies' coffers as they report what's shaping up to be a third consecutive quarter of sharp earning increases. But instead of spending on the typical things, such as expanding and hiring people, companies are mostly pocketing the money or stuffing it under their mattresses. What are their plans for this money? Again, the Washington Post. Quote, "For months, companies have been sitting on the sidelines with record piles of cash, too nervous to spend. Now they're starting to deploy some of that money, not to hire workers or build factories, but to prop up their share prices. Sitting on those unprecedented levels of cash, U.S. companies are buying back their own stock in droves so that this year, firms have announced they will purchase $273 billion of their own shares, more than five times as much compared with this time next year. But the rise in buyback signals that many companies are still hesitant to spend their cash on the job-generating activities that could produce economic growth. That's a familiar formula, as many of you know. Corporations investing in their own shares to prop up their share prices to make their stock more attractive to Wall Street, to hell with workers. Here, the chief economist at the Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, who told the Times, "There's no question that there is an income shift going on in our economy. Companies are squeezing their labor costs to build profits." He was seconded by the chief economist for Credit Suisse in New York, who described how companies, as they wrung more savings out of the workforces, causing wages and salaries barely to budge, while profits have staged a vigorous recovery, jumping 40% between late 2008 and the first quarter of 2010. Now, this story in this morning's New York Times, under the headline, "Cheap Debt Fuels Private Equity Revival." It's true. Despite a weak economy, the private equity business is roaring back. Quote, listen, "While it is difficult to get a mortgage, to buy a home, or to get a loan to fund a small business, investors are creating a robust market for corporate bonds and loans." Yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus, but he's run off with the toys. Or in modern idiom, wage repression pays dividends. No pun intended. Late in August, I clipped another story from the Wall Street Journal that Howard would have enjoyed. Above an op-ed piece by Robert Frank was the headline, "Do the Rich Need the Rest of America?" Mr. Frank didn't seem ambivalent about the answer. He wrote that as stocks have boomed, the wealthy bounce back, and while the Main Street economy is, of course, where Natalie Braswell and Natalie Ford and the Connie Brazos live and where most Americans live, the mainstream economy was racked by high unemployment and the real estate crash. The wealthy, whose financial fates were more tied to capital markets than jobs and houses, picked themselves up, brushed themselves off, and started buying luxury goods again. Citing the work of Michael Lind at the Economic Growth Program of the New American Foundation, the article went on to describe how the super rich earned their fortunes with overseas labor, selling to overseas consumers, and managing financial transactions that have little to do with the rest of America, while relying entirely or almost entirely on immigrant servants at their several homes around the country. Right at that point, I remembered another story I'd filed away, also from the Wall Street Journal, 3 years ago. The reporter described how the private equity firm Blackstone Group swooped down on a travel reservation company in Colorado, bought it, laid off 841 employees, and recouped its entire investment in just 7 months, one of the quickest returns on capital ever. Blackstone made a killing while those workers were left to sift through the debris of their lives. To make ends meet, some sold their homes, gave up their health insurance, took part-time jobs making sandwiches and coffee. And that fall, Blackstone's chief executive, Stephen Schwarzman, reportedly worth over $5 billion, rented a luxurious resort in Jamaica to celebrate the marriage of his son. According to the Guardian News, the Montego Bay facility alone cost $50,000, plus thousands more to sleep 130 guests. There were drinks on the beach, dancers and the steel band, marshmallows around the fire, and then the following day, an opulent wedding banquet with champagne and a jazz band and fireworks display that alone cost $12,500. Earlier in the year, Schwarzman had rented out the Park Avenue Armory in New York to celebrate his 60th birthday at a cost of $3 million. His 35-room apartment couldn't hold the 500 guests. So you say it's his money, isn't it? Yes, but consider this. The stratospheric income of private equity partners is taxed at only 15%. Less than the rate paid by most of you in this room and by any middle-class family. When Congress considered raising the rate on their Midas-like compensation, the financial titans flooded Washington with their well-armed mercenaries, armed with cash, and brought the debate to an end faster than it had taken Schwarzman to fire those 841 workers. The super rich had won another round in the exploitation of working people who, if they have jobs today, are paying a higher tax rate than those super rich. So the answer to the question, do the rich need the rest of America, is as stark as it is ominous. Many don't, as they form their own financial culture, increasingly separated from the fate of everyone else. It is hardly surprising, as the authors of this article concluded, that so many of them should be so hostile to paying taxes to support the infrastructure and the social programs that help the majority of the American people. Now, you would think that the rich might care, if not from empathy, then from history. Ultimately, gross inequality can be fatal to a civilization. In his book, Collapse: How Societies Choose or Fail to Succeed, the Pulitzer Prize-winning anthropologist Jared Diamond writes about how governing elites throughout history isolate and delude themselves until it's too late. He reminds us that the change people inflict on their environment is one of the main factors in the decline of earlier societies, as well as any social cohesion that came from being a member of the same ethnic or tribal group. For example, the Mayan natives on the Yucatan Peninsula who suffered as their forest disappeared, their soil eroded, and their water supply deteriorated. Chronic warfare further exhausted their dwindling resources. And although Mayan kings could see their forest vanishing and their hills eroding, they were able to insulate themselves from the rest of society. By extracting wealth from commoners, they could remain well-fed while everyone else was slowly starving. Realizing too late that they could not reverse their deteriorating environment, they became casualties of their own privilege. Any society contains a built-in blueprint for failure, Diamond warns. If elites insulate themselves from the consequences of their decision, separated from the common life of the society. The problem is they seem to relish the separation. When Howard came down to Washington last December for what would prove to be my last interview with him, I showed him this document. It had been on my desk for a long time. He came up to sit across from the desk and talk a little bit before we went down to do the interview. And I showed him this document, and he took it and leafed through it. It was published in the spring of 2005 by the Wall Street giant Citigroup, setting forth, and I can read it to you, an equity strategy with the subtitle, Revisiting Plutonomy, the Rich Getting Richer. Now, most people know, particularly at BU, what plutocracy is, the rule of the rich, political power controlled by the wealthy. Plutocracy is not an American word, and it wasn't intended to be an American phenomenon. Some of our founders, as you know, deplored what they call the veneration of wealth. But plutocracy is here, and a pumped-up Citigroup even boasted of coining a variation on the word, plutonomy. Plutonomy, an economic system where the privileged few make sure the rich get richer and the government helps them do it. 5 years ago, Citicorp decided the time had come to, quote, bang the drum on plutonomy. And my God, they banged it. Here are some excerpts from the document Revisiting Plutonomy. I am not making this up. I want to assure you of that. And I want to assure you that it's going to take us to the coming election in just a few minutes. But here's a few excerpts from Revisiting Plutonomy. Asset booms, a rising profit share, and favorable treatment by market-friendly governments, let me repeat that, favorable treatment by market-friendly governments have allowed the rich to prosper and take an increasing share of income and wealth over the last 20 years. That's not Howard Zinn saying that. That's Citigroup on Wall Street. Quote, the top 10%, particularly the top 1% of the United States, and I'm quoting them, the plutonomists in our parlance, have benefited disproportionately from the recent productivity surge in the U.S. from globalization and the productivity boom at the relative expense of labor. And, it says, they're likely to get even wealthier in the coming years because the dynamics of plutonomy are still intact. The plutonomists are doing just fine, thank you. Even better in some cases, thanks to our bailout of the big banks. As for everyone else, the Connie Brazels and Natalie Fords of America, well, listen to this summary in The Economist, not exactly a Marxist newspaper. It's one of the great business and capitalist, pro-capitalist magazines in the world. A summary in The Economist of a Pew Research study. Quote, more than half of all workers today have experienced a spell of unemployment, taken a pay cut or hours in hours or pay, or been forced to go part-time. The typical unemployed worker has been jobless for nearly 6 months. Collapsing share and house prices have destroyed a fifth of the wealth of the average household. Nearly 6 in 10 Americans have canceled or cut back on holidays. About a fifth say their mortgages are underwater. 1 in 4 of those between 18 and 29 have moved back in with their parents. Fewer than half of all adults today expect their children to have a higher standard of living than theirs, and more than a quarter say it will be lower. For many Americans, the Great Recession has been the sharpest trauma since the Second World War, wiping out jobs, wealth, and hope itself. So I have a confession to make. The legendary correspondent Edward R. Murrow told his generation of journalists that bias is okay as long as you don't try to hide it. Here's mine. Plutocracy and democracy don't mix. Plutocracy too long tolerated puts democracy on the auction block, available to the highest bidder. Democracy is the greatest break, B-R-A-K-E, the greatest break on the ravenous appetites of capital. Capital is ravenous. That's its nature. But unless you have democratic checks and balance, capital consumes everything. And that's what's been happening in our country now for at least 3 decades. Now then, it will not surprise you, I'm sure, that this degenerate and unlovely age, as one historian called it, served to inspire Karl Rove, the man who was said to be George W. Bush's brain, and now a mover and shaker of the money tree for the corporate conservative complex. The extraordinary coupling of private and political power toward the close of the 19th century, that first Gilded Age, captured Rove's attention as a younger man, especially the role of Mark Hanna, the Ohio entrepreneur who became the first modern political fundraiser. There are two things that are important in politics, Mark Hanna said. The first is money, and I can't remember the second. He didn't need to. Hanna shook down the banks, the insurance companies, the railroads, and the other industrial trusts of the late 1800s for all the money it took to make William McKinley governor of Ohio and then president of the United States. McKinley was the perfect candidate conduit for their largesse. He was one of those politicians with a talent for emitting banalities as though they were recently discovered truths. His opponent in the 1896 election was the Democratic populist candidate William Jennings Bryan, whose base, as the saying goes, consisted of aroused populists fighting to tame the rapacious theft of the public trust by the monopolies, the trusts, and the corporations that were running roughshod over the new country. Bryan was obviously a threat to those economic interests, and he succeeded only in raising 1/10 of the money that Mark Hanna raised for McKinley. And we know who won. Money in politics is an old story. Karl Rove studied Hanna and would have learned from his study the principles of plutonomy. Because Hannah believed, and this is a quote, the state of Ohio existed for property. It had no other function. Great wealth was to be gained through monopoly, through using the state for private ends. It was axiomatic, therefore, that businessmen should run the government and run it for personal profits. He and McKinley, therefore, saw to it that first Ohio and then Washington were ruled by bankers, railroads, and public utility corporations. The United States was famous, as you know, as a millionaire's club. City halls, state houses, even courtrooms were bought and sold like baubles. And instead of enforcing the rules of fair play, which is what government is all about, government began to serve as the valet of the super rich. The young journalist Henry George, a hero of mine, wrote that an immense wedge was being forced through American society by the maldistribution of wealth, status, and opportunity. The historian Clinton Rossiter described this era as the great train robbery of American intellectual history. Conservatives of the day, pro-corporate apologists, hijacked the vocabulary of Jefferson liberalism and turned words like progress, opportunity, and individualism into tools for making the plunder of America sound like divine right. Laissez-faire ideologues and neocons of the day, lovers of empire even then, hijacked Charles Darwin's theory of evolution and so distorted it that politicians, judges, and publicists gleefully embraced the notion that progress emerges from the elimination of the weak and the survival of the fittest. As one of the plutocrats in New York crowed, "We are rich. We own America. We got it. God knows how, but we intend to keep it." And that has been the fundamental conflict and fight and struggle in American life, in American politics, in democracy for 150 years now. And the Gilded Age has returned with a vengeance. It slipped in quietly at first, back in the early 1980s when Ronald Reagan began a massive, decades-long transfer of national wealth to the rich. Roger Hoke says, under Bill Clinton, the transfer was even more dramatic as the top 10% captured an ever-growing share of national income. The trend, of course, continued under George W. Bush. Remember the tax cuts for the very wealthy? And by 2007, the wealthiest 10% of Americans were taking in 50% of the national income. And today, a fraction of people at the top earn more than the 120 million Americans at the bottom. A fraction of the people at the top, less than 1%, today earn more than the bottom 120 million Americans. You will hear it said, "Well, warriors, this is the way the world works." No, it's the way the world is made to work. This vast inequality, this huge gulf that separates the two Americas, is not the result of Adam Smith's invisible hand. It did not just happen. It was no accident. It was the result of a long series of public policy decisions about industry and trade, taxation and military spending by flesh and blood human beings like you sitting in concrete and steel buildings. And those policy decisions were paid for by the less than 1% of our population who participate in democratic capitalism through campaign contributions. So over the last 30 years, with the complicity of both political parties, the plutocrats, or the plutonomists, choose your own poison, have used their vastly increased wealth to assure that government does their bidding. Remember that reference in this document to the market-friendly governments on the side of plutonomy? It calls to mind the story I heard growing up in Texas about the poker game in which the dealer says, "Now play the cards fairly, Reuben. I know what I dealt you." And that's what's been happening in this country. You know, looking back, it all seems so clear that we wonder how we could have ignored the warning signs at the moment. One of the few journalists who was prophetic, Thomas Edsel of the Washington Post, now at the Columbia School of Journalism, reported that, quote, business has refined its ability to act as a class, submerging competitive instincts in favor of joint cooperative action in the legislative arena. Big business political action committees flooded that political arena with a deluge of dollars. They funded think tanks that churned out study after study with results skewing to their ideology and interest. And they cleverly built alliances with the religious right, Jerry Falwell's Moral Majority, and Pat Robertson's Christian Coalition, who zealously waged a cultural holy war that camouflaged the economic assault on working people and the middle class. Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan also tried to warn us. He said President Reagan's real strategy was to force the government to cut domestic social programs by fostering federal deficits of historic dimensions. Pat Moynihan was gone before the financial catastrophe that occurred on George W. Bush's watch that could yet fulfill Reagan's dream. The plutocrats who soaked up all that money that we've been talking about now say that the deficits stretching into the future require putting Social Security and other public services on the chopping block. Mr. Bush said that his biggest regret of his 8 years in the presidency was not invading Iraq on false premises at the cost of over $1 trillion or more, but his failure to privatize Social Security. With over 100 incumbent Republicans of the House having signed a pledge to do just that when the new Congress convenes in January, Mr. Bush's dream, like Ronald Reagan's dream, may yet be realized. Daniel Altman also saw what was coming. I recommend to you his book, Neo-Economy, in which he describes a place without taxes or a social safety net where rich and poor people live in different financial worlds. It's coming to America, he wrote 15 years ago. I'm not sure even he could have foreseen the day that firefighters in rural Tennessee would let a home burn to the ground because the owner couldn't pay a fee of $75. And so the beat goes on. And here we are on the verge of the biggest commercial transaction in the history of American elections. Nearly $4 billion is being spent on the congressional races that will be decided next week. Much of that money, as you've heard, as we know, is coming from secret slush funds, almost impossible to trace. The organization Public Citizen reports that just 10 groups are responsible for the bulk of spending by independent organizations. Quote, a tiny number of organizations relying on a tiny number of corporate and fat cat contributors are spending most of the money on the vicious attack ads dominating the airwaves. Those are the words of Public Citizen's president, Robert Weissman. The Federal Election Committee said a few days ago that 2 years ago, 97% of groups paying for these election ads disclosed the names of their donors. 97%. This year, 32%. Donors are laundering their cash through front groups like highfalutin names like American Crossroads. That's one of the two slush funds controlled by Karl Rove in his ambition to bring back the era of robber barons. Promise me you won't laugh when I tell you that although Rove and his powerful Washington lobbyist friend, who is his accomplice, described their first organization as, quote, grassroots, 97% of its initial contributions came from four billionaires. Yes, indeed, the grass grows mighty high when the roots are fertilized with gold. Rove, other conservative groups, and the Chamber of Commerce have, in fact, created a shadow party determined to be the real power in Washington, just like Rome's Opus Dei in Dan Brown's The Da Vinci Code. And in this shadow party, the plutocrats reign. We have reached what the new chairman of Common Cause and former Labor Secretary Robert Reich, known to so many of you, calls the perfect storm that threatens American democracy an unprecedented concentration of income and wealth at the top, a record amount of secret money flooding our democracy, and a public becoming increasingly angry and cynical about a government that's raising its taxes, reducing its services, and unable to get it back to work. We are losing our democracy to a different system, says Bob Reich. It's called plutocracy. That word again. But he's right. That fraction of 1% of Americans who now earn as much as the 120 Americans at the bottom includes the top executives of major corporations, those Wall Street hedge fund and private equity operators who constitute Citigroup's plutonomy, and they're buying our democracy, and they're buying it secretly. That's because early this year, the five reactionary members of the Supreme Court ruled that corporations are persons with the right to speak during elections by funding ads like those now flooding the airwaves. Now, it's hard for patriots like you to know, to admit it. Hard for me to admit it. But the United States Supreme Court has promulgated a big lie. Corporations are not people. They're legal fictions, creatures of the state, born not of the womb, not of flesh and blood, but of the imagination of fabulists. They're not permitted to vote. They don't bear arms, except that now they can drop a nuclear bomb on a congressional campaign and nobody will know where it came from. Yet five men in black robes have bestowed on corporations the privilege of personhood to speak, and not in their own voice, mind you, but as ventriloquists using their money to hire their puppets. Do they really think that that's what the authors of the First Amendment intended? Horrified by this perversion of the First Amendment, the editor of the spunky Texas Observer, Bob Moser, got it right with his headline, "So long, democracy. It's been good to know you." I said that this is the work of fabulists. You'll remember that soon after the court's decision, President Obama raised the matter during his State of the Union speech in January. He said the decision would unleash a torrent of corrupting corporate money into our political system. Sitting a few feet in front of the president, about where you are, Associate Justice Samuel Alito defiantly mouthed the words, "Not true. Not true. Not true." It was a remarkable revelation of the majority's mindset. Alito was either disingenuous, naive, or deluded. He cannot be in this world without knowing he and his four fellow corporatists were giving big donors the one thing they must most want in their campaign against working people, an unfair advantage. Alan Grayson lives in the real world. He's a member of Congress. Here's what he said. "We're now in a situation where a lobbyist can walk into my office and say, 'I've got $5 million to spend, and I can spend it for you or against you. Which will it be?'" My friend and colleague Michael Winship, a columnist, told a story this week to illuminate the Supreme Court's coup de grace against democracy. It seems the incorrigible George Bernard Shaw once propositioned a fellow dinner guest, asking if she would go to bed with him for £1 million. That's about $1.5 million in today's terms. She agreed. Shaw then asked her if she would do the same for 10 shillings. "What do you take me for?" she asked angrily. "A prostitute?" Shaw responded, "We've established that principle, madam. Now we're just haggling over the price." With this one decision, seriously, with this one decision, the Supreme Court established once and for all that Shaw's is the only principle left in politics as long as the price is right. So go with me to Washington's red light district to call on the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the front group for the plutocracy's prostitution of politics. The chamber boasts that it represents more than 3 million businesses and approximately 300,000 members. But actually, it has almost nothing to do with the shops and stores along the street here around Boston University. In the words of the economics journalist Zach Carter, the chairman's branding allows them to disguise their political agenda as a coalition of local businesses while it does the dirty work for corporate titans. Carter says that when the Supreme Court decision came down with this infamous ruling early this year, the chamber responded, knowing it was going to get secret money, by announcing a 40% increase in its political spending operations. Then, after the money started flowing in, the chamber boosted its budget again by 50%. According to a recent investigative report in the New York Times early this week, nearly half of the chamber's funding, even before the Supreme Court decision, came from just 45 sources. And those contributions coincided with lobbying or political campaigns that potentially affected the donors. The Times concluded that the Chamber of Commerce has increasingly relied on a relatively small collection of big corporate donors, the plutocracy's senior ranks, to finance much of its legislative and political agenda. And if you wonder where the restraints of democracy have gone, if you wonder what's happened to the checks and balances that are supposed to hold amoral capitalism in some check and responsible to the body politic, to the public welfare, there's your answer. Furthermore, the New York Times story said the chamber makes no apologies for its policy of not identifying its donors. It has vigorously opposed legislation in Congress that would require groups like it to identify their biggest contributors when they spend money on campaign ads. Now, let's quickly connect some dots. When the House of Representatives recently passed a bill, that would require that the names of all such donors be publicly disclosed, every Republican in the Senate opposed it. And there it died. I'm smiling because smiling is the only response to hypocrisy. Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell had actually claimed that the Sunshine Laws would make everything okay by letting people see who was buying their election. Well, no sooner did the public start singing "Let the Sunshine In" than McConnell lined up every Republican in the Senate to black out the windows. When the chief lobbyist for the Chamber of Commerce was asked by an interviewer, "Are you guys eventually going to disclose?" the answer was a brisk no. So they will not reveal the corporate sources of their slush fund, said to be $75 million or more, because those corporations are afraid of a backlash from people like you. Doesn't that tell you something about the nature of what they're doing? It reminds me of those words from a character in Tom Stoppard's play, Night and Day. People do terrible things to each other, but it's worse in places where everything is kept in the dark. And that's true in politics. So it turns out, it won't surprise you, that many of these ads paid for secretly by anonymous donors are, quote, false, grossly misleading, or marred with distortions, as Greg Sargent reports in his website, The Plumb Line. Go there, theplumbline.org, and you'll see a partial list of ads that illustrate the scope of the intellectual and political fraud being perpetrated in front of our eyes. Money from secret sources is poisoning the public mind with toxic misinformation in order to dupe voters into giving even more power to the powerful. On another site, Think Progress, you can find out what you need to know about the multi-billionaire Koch brothers, also big oil producers, and Tea Party supporters. They're recruiting captains of industry to fund the right-wing infrastructure of front groups, political campaigns, think tanks, and media outlets. And among the right-wing luminaries who showed up at one of these secretive network meetings of Republican donors were two Supreme Court justices, right-wingers Antonin Scalia and Clarence Thomas. I said you can't make this up. Listen. Two of the five votes for corporate slush funds on the Supreme Court of the United States came from justices who were present as members of the plutocracy schemed to take over our government. Now then, something else is going on here. The Koch brothers have contributed significantly to efforts to stop the Affordable Care Act, the health care reforms, from taking effect. Justice Clarence Thomas's wife, Virginia, claims those reforms are unconstitutional, and she's organized to repeal them. She's leading a movement to repeal them. Think about it. Her own husband may one day be ruling on whether she's right or not. And there's more. Virginia Thomas founded an organization based at Jerry Falwell's University to kill those health care reforms. Also a goal, by the way, of the Koch brothers. Her organization got started with $500,000 from an unnamed donor and is now funded by secret contributions from sources whose identity we journalists can't know and you, the voting public, will never know. Is it conceivable that some of those donors are corporations that stand to benefit from favorable decisions by the Supreme Court? Listen, you know, this truly puzzles me. It's what I can't figure out about the conservative mindset. The Kochs, I can understand, messianic Daddy Warbucks who can't imagine what life is like for people who don't make $21 billion a year. But whatever happened to passionate conservatism? I mean, the Affordable Care Act, whatever its flaws, and it has flaws, extends health care coverage to over 40 million deprived Americans who would not otherwise be covered. What is it about these people, the Clarence and Virginia Thomases, the secret donors, the privileged plutocrats on their side, that they can't embrace a little social justice where it counts among everyday people struggling to get by in a dog-eat-dog world? Mrs. Thomas is obviously doing okay. Surely she takes a reasonable salary from that private slush fund working to undermine health care reforms. Her own husband's health care is provided by the government, by you. They're comfortable. Why wouldn't she want people who are less fortunate to have a little security, too? She works with a university that identifies itself as Christian, part of the moral majority. How come she's only about live and let live? Is there no space in her faith for the mustard seed of the gospel message that says live and help live? Why would this cushioned crowd resort to such despicable tactics, using secret money to try to turn public policy against their less fortunate neighbors, and in the process compromise the already tattered integrity of the United States Supreme Court? I don't get it. You be the judge, because if you don't, Clarence Thomas will. Time to close the circle. My friend Robert Reich reminds us in a recent essay that millions of Americans are in trouble. They've lost, as I said, their jobs, their homes, and their savings. Their grown children have moved back in them. Their state and local taxes are rising. Teachers and firefighters are being laid off. The roads and bridges they count on are crumbling. Pipelines are leaking. Schools are dilapidated. And private libraries are being shut. Why isn't government working for them? Because it's been bought off. Until we get clean money, we're not going to get clean elections. And until we get clean elections, you can kiss goodbye. Government of, by, and for the people. Welcome to the plutocracy. Now, obviously, Howard would not have us leave it there. What can we do? I can almost hear Howard throwing that question back at us. Organize. Yes, organize. And don't count the cost, is what he used to tell a lot of young people. And I have to tell you that many people already are. They're mobilizing. There's a rumbling in the land. The corporate media, and I don't mean a tea party. The corporate media may not pick it up. But despite the odds, folks are organizing on various fronts against big money in politics and the secrecy that surrounds it. By taking on big money, we're talking about something more than a single interest issue. What Howard would ask us to think about is not so much a progressive revival as a radical reawakening to the promise of this country and to our capacity as citizens to act together. Frederick Douglass was right. Power concedes nothing without a struggle. Even with most Americans on our side, the odds are long. Money fights hard, and it fights dirty. Think Roe. the Chamber, the Kochs. We could lose. It all may be impossible. But hear me. It's okay if it's impossible. You heard me right. I've learned something about this from the farm worker and now labor organizer, Baldima Velasquez. The members of his farm labor organizing committee are a long way from the world of K Street's lobbyists. But they took on the Campbell Soup Company and won. They took on North Carolina growers and won. They took on, and by the way, they used transnational organizing techniques there that won him a genius award from the MacArthur Foundation. And now they're taking on R.J. Reynolds Tobacco and one of its principal financial sponsors, J.P. Morgan Chase, whose head is a good friend of Barack Obama's. Now, some people have questioned the wisdom of taking on such powerful interests, but here's what Valeska says. It's okay if it's impossible. It's okay. Now he says, I'm going to speak to you as organizers. Listen carefully. The object is not to win. That's not the objective. The objective is to do the good and right thing. If you decide not to do anything because it's too hard or too impossible, then nothing will be done. And when you're on your deathbed, you're going to say, I wish I had done something. But if you go and do the right thing now, long enough, he says, good things will happen. Something's going to happen. Shades of Howard Zinn. Thank you.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard the 2010 Howard Zinn Memorial Lecture, honoring the late Boston University Professor Emeritus of Political Science. The featured speaker was veteran broadcast journalist and political commentator Bill Moyers. Mr. Moyers was introduced by Alex McDonald, Boston University College of Arts and Sciences, class of 1972. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, WBUR.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth, with help from Mark Liambruni. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Steve Brown. Thanks for joining us.